Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast. Hello, Andrew. Welcome to the beautiful ancient town of Rye on the Kent coast. Aren't I lucky?
You're a jet setter. So yes, we like to come from different locations.
You do, yes. I've been having a little weekend here with some friends, and it's pouring with rain. So I'm sitting inside thinking about our podcast and looking at so many amazing comments on the last show. Some of them very funny too.
Yes, I think we've been compared to the two Muppets.
Yes, best comment ever. Let me see if I can find it. Somebody said, "I normally listen to this podcast." It was Yorkie 238 or 23D. I normally listen to your podcast. But it's nice to watch it on YouTube and see you as you are. And then Tina Jesse jumped in and said, yes, same here. And they remind me of Statler and Waldorf from The Muppets, the two miserable critics who are always saying everything's terrible.
So maybe we should encourage listeners to put in ideas of who they think we look like, if it's isn't George Bush. And I can't remember who you're meant to be. Some pop star, I think.
An American comedian that I'd never heard of. But now people enjoyed the talk. It was rather topical, our talk about Andrew, especially in the week when there was another big royal story about the photograph going all wrong.
Yes, well, that's a running story.
That is running. Well, let's talk about that in a sec. I just want to mention Nick Greetham here. Said, because he tuned in for spies, because that's what we were going to do and what we're now doing today. He said, no spies, but instead freedom of information and official porcupines, which if you're not British, it means lies. Another great episode. So that was very nice.
Yes, it's doing well. I think we're close to 2,000 downloads on YouTube alone.
We are. That's only a day ago it went out. So it's been one of our best, actually, in recent months. So thank you for that. And keep listening, keep subscribing. And we should talk a little bit about this Kate thing, don't you think, with the photograph?
Yes, I think it's very serious because it does go to my argument has always been that the royal family have been trying to shape the narrative. And people have taken that narrative on trust. And I think that trust is now broken. And we have to ask, how many other pictures have been doctored? Why? I mean, they're also making the situation far worse, I think. So in some ways, it's the cover-up always is worse than the original crime. And, there's stories that even the pictures that have been released showing her in a car have been doctored or are old pictures. And I think it's become pretty clear this picture comes from November. So why, if they're going to release a picture, have they not released a recent picture?
It is very perplexing, isn't it? And what they thought they were doing, because they must be aware, there must be somebody in the operation around William and Kate who knows that everybody's on the lookout now in the age of AI for doctored photos. They could just get away with some kind of strange montage.
Yes, well, it's kind of underwritten the sort of the whole illusion of the royal family, and I mean there are all big questions. Why has she gone out of public view for so long? Why did William disappear at 45 minutes' notice from his godfather's funeral? And we have this other story, actually, also about Harry and his visa. You know, did he put down his visa form that he'd taken drugs, or did he not? There's a difference of what he says in his book and what he presumably wrote on his form. And there's a big case there with people trying to discover or have this visa form released. You know, anyone else who had admitted to taking drugs would not have been allowed into America. So it's, again, this, you know, one rule for one lot and one rule for another. And people are challenging that. And it's very interesting. The pressure has come from social media, not from the press. The press have finally jumped onto this now. But, you know, it's citizen journalists and social media which are actually beginning to ask some of the tough questions that, you know, only a limited number of journalists have been asking so far.
Golly, okay. Well, we did promise people spies, a week of spies, and we're going to deliver on that promise. But across 2 weeks, so today being Wednesday when this show goes up, and then another one on Sunday. And this one is a story that several people wrote to us about. It's one of those great untold 60s spy stories that isn't really as famous as the Cambridge spies, but in some senses was more dramatic. The story of John Vassal, which you know a lot about. Do you want to sort of paint the background?
I've just read Alex Grant's book, and I did know a little bit about it. I mean, it'd always been overshadowed by the Profumo affair. But I think he makes a very strong case. Two things. One is that it was sort of as important as Profumo in turning in making people much more sort of suspicious of the establishment. But also that this poor man was crucified, really. He'd been raped, in effect, by the Russians. He wasn't an easy, what we call a walk-in. And then blackmailed. In some ways, it is a sort of human tragedy, the whole story. He probably could have just confessed to the British authorities and been whisked out, and there wouldn't have been the spying going on. But, of course, this is this period, 62, 63, is the height of James Bond. It's the height of the spy mania, really, both in real life and also in films.
And all of the things you wrote about with Guy Burgess, and those the men linked to him, had all of that already come out? And were people sort of primed to look for spies in a way they hadn't been before?
Well, I think, I mean, Burgess escaped in 1951, but he died in August 1963, so very much at this time. And we had, of course, the flight of Philby in January 1963. So, yeah, spies were very much a big thing. Things were beginning to come out, and the witch hunts were going on to find out, you know, was there a fifth man, a sixth man, etc. So Vassal was sort of caught up in all this. And funny enough, by chance today, I was sitting at the side one of the characters in this book, a man called Galbraith, who was a minister, and his son was at the next door table. So it shows you how sort of strong the continuity of this story is, really.
All right. Well, that's all really interesting. So we're going to talk to this chap, Alex, about Vassal, and then in a few days' time, we'll have our second show of this little spy week, which is The Body in the Bag, which we'll maybe talk about at the end of this program. But I guess we should also say to people, how are you feeling about having two shows a week? The numbers are good. People really are listening and watching. It is basically doubled what we would normally get in a week. So from that respect, it's a bit of a success. I'm just a bit worried about keeping up the quality over 100 shows a year. Can we do it, do you think?
I think we can do it. We have lots of good contacts, and they're always good stories. And, you know, we will have some people back to update us on some sort of running stories. Some of these raw stories are just continue. But, yeah, I think we can find sort of 100 scandals a year. That should be no problem.
All right, then. Well, let's hope we can. And we'll talk at the end of this particular interview about what's coming up next. See you soon.
Right. Well, we're very pleased to have Alex Grant today talking about the spy case John Vassal. It's a story that a lot of our listeners have asked to know more about. And Alex has just published a well-received book on Vassal based on research with new archives, particularly new material from MI5. But Alex, can you give us just a rundown on the Vassal case?
Yeah, John Vassal was a young Englishman, Andrew, born in 1924, son of a clergyman, who went to school in Monmouth just before the start of the war, had his first sexual experiences. It's fair to say that from his mid-teen onwards, he was very clear about his sexuality. He was he was a gay man, was forced to leave school at the age of 16 because his father could no longer afford to pay its fees. So in 1941, at the age of only 16, he became a clerk, firstly at the Midland Bank, and then secondly at the Admiralty in London, served in the RAF for a year or two at the very end of the war, then came back to the Admiralty as a clerk, and kind of stayed there in a very lowly position for the next 20 years or so. It's important to point out that although he was from quite a respectable background as a clergyman's son, because his education had been curtailed, he was always in a very, very junior clerical position in the Admiralty. So he was very much on the border of two social classes, which in my view is one of the reasons why, though certainly not the only reason, one of the reasons why he became a spy. So in 1954, he was seconded to the British Embassy in Moscow, worked there as a personal assistant to the naval attaché, and fell into the company of a group of Russian men, naively not realizing that they were almost all covert KGB agents who had been sent to befriend him for the for one purpose and one purpose only, which was to sexually entrap him. So at a party at the Hotel Berlin in Moscow, probably in October 1954, though the precise date is still uncertain, he was invited to a party in a private room of the hotel. His wine was spiked, and he was gang raped by at least two other men, and photographs of these events were then used to blackmail him into handing secrets over to the Russians for a 7-year period. It started while he was still in Moscow. From 1956 onwards, he was back in the Admiralty in London. So he was not finally unmasked until September 1962, probably at least 7 years after he'd begun spying. So it was a huge furore at the time because it came on the back of other spy scandals in 1960 and 1961, George Blake, the Portland spies, etc. And the immediate question mark was not about, the immediate question that was raised was not how well the British have done to finally unmask a prolific Russian spy, but why did it take 7 years to unmask him? And during that 7-year period, there had been quite a lot of clues that Vassil had been living beyond his means, had been receiving some money from the Russians, which had paid for a lifestyle that was considered beyond the means of an ordinary, poorly paid Admiralty clerk. And also the crucial information that led to Vassil's unmasking in 1962 had come from the Russians via the CIA, so via the Americans. And the Americans had given the British some very heavy clues about Vassil's identity in early 1962, if not before. So there was another question mark about why it had taken many months, if not a year or two, for MI5 and the Special Branch and the Admiralty to put two and two together and identify the suspected spy as John Vassil.
So how important were these documents he had access to that he leaked to the Soviets? Were they? He said he was a fairly minor official, but was he able to get his hands on, kind of really important stuff?
Yeah, I mean, there's still some uncertainty over exactly what he handed over because Vassil did not keep a complete list. The Russian archives are, for obvious reasons, rather difficult to access at the moment. But certainly we've managed to piece together quite a lot of information from what the defectors who unmasked Vassil told MI5 at the time. And perhaps paradoxically, because Vassil was always a very junior official, that meant he didn't specialise, and he actually had access to a pretty wide range of secrets about the ships of the Royal Navy, in particular its submarines, the nuclear submarines.
Oh, wow.
Nuclear weapons, radar, and things like that. So it's fair to say, although the significance of the case was slightly downplayed at the time to minimise British government embarrassment, it's fair to say that all the evidence that has come to light since proves he was firstly, a very prolific spy, and also the stuff he did hand over was of a lot of value to the Russians.
And was this, do you think it was mostly the blackmail that made him do it? Or was it, you say he was also paid? Was he in any way politically sympathetic to the Soviets?
Very good questions, Phil. To take them in order, he was paid not an enormous sum of money. And there was a lot of ridiculous speculation in the press after his arrest that he had a big sort of secret stash of Russian gold. He was probably paid what would nowadays be termed a part-time salary. And the amount of money he got from the Russians each year was considerably less than the rather modest sum he was paid by the Admiralty for his very junior job there. So it helped him to live in a flat in Dolphin Square, which is a fairly salubrious address. It wasn't a very large flat. It was actually a very small flat, but it was very, very well furnished. He also did an awful lot of foreign travel. After he came back from Moscow in 56, he did go on up to a dozen foreign holidays per year across Europe and beyond, which in the days before budget airlines, was a lot of travel and should have raised eyebrows among his employers. In terms of his ideology, he was not in any way an ideological spy. And there's a crucial difference between Vassil and the Cambridge spies, because firstly, the Cambridge spies were a network who knew about each other's existence. Vassil was completely a lone operator. His only contact were with a very small number of Russian handlers, both in Moscow and in London. He was not part of a larger network. There were lots of rumours at the time that he had been part of, or at least aware of, the Portland spy network in the early 60s, but he almost certainly wasn't. He had actually been a member of the Young Conservatives in Marylebone before going out to Moscow he joined in the late 40s or early 50s. He was also a member of the Conservative Club on St. James's Street. So he was not in any way an ideological communist, was in no way sympathetic towards Soviet communism. And my view is that although the gifts of money and luxury goods occasionally from his Russian handlers helped to sweeten the pill, I largely see him as a somewhat naive but innocent victim of blackmail rather than a spy who sold secrets. Because in fact, the money only started arriving after he started handing over secrets rather than before. He wasn't, it's not as if he sort of negotiated a tariff to hand over secrets to the Russians. He was told, you must hand it over, otherwise we'll reveal these photos to all and sundry.
Did he not feel he could go to someone and report this? After all, other people had been compromised in Moscow. I mean, Jeffrey Harrison, for example, ambassador, was just recalled and given a knighthood. I mean, did he not feel he could talk to people and that he'd just be whisked out?
Well, he could have potentially done so. I mean, the crucial difference is that, Jeffrey Harrison, as you rightly say, Andrew, was caught. In case viewers aren't aware of this, Jeffrey Harrison was our man in Moscow, and in 1967, I think it was, he was basically entrapped by a chambermaid. He had an affair with a chambermaid who then, surprise, surprise, said photographs had been taken of their assignations and needed to hand secrets over to her, other Russians, to prevent these photographs from being released. He did go straight to his superiors, the Foreign Office, was recalled to London, and in the end, given a knighthood. The crucial difference is that A, he was an ambassador, and B, it was a heterosexual entrapment that he'd been victim of rather than homosexual entrapment.
And of course, we should probably say at this point, because people might not know, it was illegal basically to have gay sex in Britain at this time, and would remain so until, 67, wasn't it?
67. So, I mean, the Vassil's arrest fell exactly halfway between the Wolfenden report of 57, which had recommended decriminalization, and the final decriminalization of some homosexual activities, not all, in 1967. Andrew, to go back to your question, I mean, Vassil could, at least in theory, have said to his superiors, "Oh, by the way, I'm gay. And I've been very stupid. I fell into the company of some Russian men and they spiked my drink at a party, and they raped me, and they took photographs of the event, and they're using it to blackmail me." the fear he had, rightly or wrongly, is that had he done so, A, his diplomatic career, for what it was worth, and although it was in a very junior position, he did have some rather sort of grand, you know, Walter Mitty's or fantasies about becoming a private secretary at, you know, 10 Downing Street one day. His, you know, diplomatic and civil service career would have been over, but also he feared he may well have been prosecuted either for homosexual activity or espionage or both on recall to London. So rightly or wrongly, and I certainly think Vassal made, you know, many mistakes, but rightly or wrongly, he decided that the easiest course of action was to play along with what the Russians were asking. And of course, it was a classic example of psychological, you know, manipulation that the KGBs were masters at, in that initially he was told, oh, we're not asking for any important secrets. We just want your, you know, general impressions about your colleagues at the embassy and about British attitudes towards the Cold War and British attitudes towards homosexuality. So he was very, very gently, you know, coaxed into spying. It was only several months later, shortly before he left Moscow, probably in late 55, about a year after he'd first been entrapped, that they started asking for documents.
Because, I mean, I'm enjoying your book, and it seems to me that the book is not just a spy story. It's a book about attitudes to homosexuality, yeah, and all sorts of other things, actually. It's a much wider book than that, just a straight spy story.
Just, I mean, you'll find this funny. I'm sure you know this, but our friend Jonathan Brewer, when he heard we were going to talk to you, said to us, a press cutting from 1962. It would have been, I guess, the court case. This is the Daily Mirror in my lifetime, our lifetimes. The headline is, how can we spot a possible homo?
Yeah.
The Admiralty, it's the Foreign Office,
yeah,
they don't seem to know, but the Sunday Mirror is here to offer you some useful advice.
Yes, yes, that was that woman.
Yes, that was just after. That was just after.
But it just shows you that, I mean, the ridiculous things about, you know, if he's wearing a particular kind of suit, or if he's, you know, if he's going to particular kind of plays, he might be a homo. So best to be avoided because he's probably a spy. I mean, it is another world. It's a lost world, and thank God it's a lost world. But really, that was a big factor in perhaps what Vassal was thinking. How he, you know.
Yes, I mean, he, I mean, so Andrew, thanks for your kind words about the book. I see this as not only a, you know, fascinating story in its own right, but also a chunk of early 1960s British history, which has largely been forgotten about. And I think the reason why the Vassal case, while it was massive, massive news at the time and was in the headlines for, you know, weeks on end in late 62 and early 63, the reason it's been subsequently forgotten about is that, A, it was an embarrassment both to the LGBT lobby, because, you know, Vassal was in not, it was in no way a hero, even an anti-hero. He was a tragic victim. Secondly, it was an embarrassment to the British security establishment, because I think they still feel embarrassed to this day about, you know, the homophobia that Vassal's arrest unleashed. And also they feel embarrassed about the fact that they hadn't caught him earlier. And I think the third reason, which is kind of related to the first two, is that the Profumo scandal, which happened only a couple of months later, is very much remembered today. In my view, largely not because of its security significance, but because it has a cast of young women in swimsuits, whereas the cast of the John Vassal story is almost entirely male, and it is an LGBT story rather than a heterosexual one. And, I mean, there are a number of important landmarks of British post-war history that are hidden in the Vassal story. Just to give two quick examples, I mean, the reason why, you know, positive vetting as we now know it, in other words, if you're above a certain level of seniority in the civil service or have access to you know, sensitive secrets, you are very, very, very intensely vetted, and conversations are had with family, friends, former employers, former colleagues, etc. The introduction of that very robust system in the mid-60s was largely as a response, very much closing the, you know, stable door after the horse had bolted, very much a response to the Vassal case. In terms of media history, after Vassal's conviction, there was a public inquiry led by Lord Cyril Radcliffe, a Lord of Appeal, and that inquiry led to two reporters being jailed for contempt of court for refusing to reveal sources of stories they had written about Vassal. That was the last time in British history that reporters were sent to jail.
I never knew that.
For refusing to reveal their sources. But also, perhaps more importantly, the tabloid furore about the Vassal case, which led to an entirely blameless government minister being forced to resign, was, in my view, the first sort of recognisably modern, you know, tabloid witch hunt in British history. So it was a landmark in media history as well as political and social history.
Yeah, I think I'm right in saying there was a kind of spy mania, wasn't there? I mean, the James Bond, the very first James Bond film was out that year. Was it Dr. No? I don't know. I can't remember.
Yes, it was Dr. No.
And obviously the Cuban Missile Crisis was very shortly after, or maybe even at the same time.
Well, the first day of the Cuban Missile Crisis, October 22nd, 1962, was the day of John Vassal's sentencing here.
Really? Oh my goodness!
It was actually, strictly speaking, not a trial, but he, pleaded guilty. But there are some interesting historical coincidences here, and you're right. Dr. No came out, I think, a couple of weeks either before or after his arrest. I think it was after his arrest in the autumn of 62. So there was a big contrast between the suave, modern master of espionage as portrayed by Sean Connery and the slightly bumbling, incompetent reality.
Gosh, and I mean, Macmillan wanted to shut the story down, didn't he? This famous story always says, you know, when my gamekeeper kills a fox, he buries it in the garden. And presumably this was concern about a trial and embarrassment with the Russians. I mean, even sometime after the Burgess escape, I mean, there was still clearly an embarrassment about what had happened with the Americans.
Yes, and it's fair to say that from the very beginning, Macmillan was unhappy about Vassal's capture because he predicted rightly that the reaction would not be, you know, applause for the efficiency of the British state in catching a spy, but immediate questions about why he hadn't been caught sooner. It's important to point out at this point, gentlemen, that Vassal had worked between 57 and 59 in the private office of an Admiralty minister called Tam Galbraith. The press got it into their heads that a friendship had developed between Vassal and Galbraith while they were working in the same office. But it hadn't just been a friendship, according to the press. It had become a form of a sexual relationship. And Galbraith had not only been aware of Vassal's espionage, had also potentially been an accomplice in it. And believe it or not, when Vassal was arrested in September 1962, he and Galbraith had been on the verge of defecting to Moscow together. So I think some of Macmillan's rage at the press was fully justified in that, although a platonic friendship of sorts had developed between Vassal and Galbraith, and there had been correspondence between them both while they were working together and after, there is no evidence at all that they had any kind of sexual relationship, and certainly no evidence that, you know, Galbraith was aware of Vassal's espionage. So poor old Galbraith was a sacrificial lamb and was forced to resign in November 1962. And although he very briefly returned to ministerial office a few months later after his exoneration in 63-64, he was then, you know, stuck on the back benches for the next 18 years. And there are other you know, tragic victims of this case, including some of Vassal's friends in the civil service and the military who, well, had certainly been his friends, had potentially been his lovers, and who, in the kind of, you know, backlash to the Vassal case, found their careers either very severely curtailed or in some cases abruptly terminated, not because they had been aware of or accomplices in Vassal spying, but purely that they had known him socially and may or indeed may not have slept with him.
So was there any sympathy for him? Was there anybody saying, hang on a minute, this guy, he's done some bad things, but, you know, he's blackmailed, it's not his fault so much, let's go easy on him? I mean, because he was sentenced to, actually, I don't really know, it was a hefty sentence, wasn't it?
It was 18 years and he served 10. where he was represented at the Old Bailey, although he pleaded guilty, there wasn't much that his defence lawyers could do with, could do for him, other than to make a plea of, you know, mitigation. His defence lawyer was Jeremy Hutchinson, who was, you know, supposedly one of the models, you know, for Ron Pole of the Bailey.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
He was the star barrister of the day. He'd been involved in a number of, you know, spying trials in the early 60s, both before and after Vassal. He'd also been involved in the Lady Chatterley's lover trial. So he was a very liberal and very erudite and learned man. And I'm not sure, from all the evidence that I've seen, I'm not sure that Vassal actually told anyone, including his defence barrister, Jeremy Hutchinson, the full story about exactly what had happened in the Hotel Berlin. And he did finally tell the full story, but not until 1975, after his release from prison, when he published a memoir. I think, like many victims of rape, both heterosexual and homosexual, Vassal felt guilty. He blamed himself. He felt very embarrassed about it. So he was always rather vague about exactly what form the entrapment had been taken. And to this day, when people write about the Vassal case, they often allege, quite wrongly, that Vassal had, you know, willingly taken part in a sexual encounter or been, you know, betrayed by a lover, etc., etc. So when it came to his trial, the only real, not actually it wasn't even a trial at all, it was a sentencing hearing, technically. All Jeremy Hutchinson could really do was to say this man's a weak young man with a chip on his shoulder about having not been promoted to a more senior position. He was exploited by the Russians. Oh, and by the way, the stuff he handed over wasn't all that significant. So it was not a very, which you know, does seem very surprising to modern eyes. I mean, sitting here in 2024, one would hope that had this, you know, if this happened today, you know, Vassal would be able to say to the police and to a courtroom, I've been the victim of rape and they tried to blackmail me. Mm. And that would, would not necessarily exonerate him, but would be important mitigation in the event he got 18 years, not quite as long as the sentence that other spies got. I mean, George Blake had been sentenced to 42 years a couple of years earlier, but it was effectively it wasn't a life sentence, but it was certainly a very long sentence. He was released after only 10 years because he was a model prisoner. And perhaps more importantly, he wasn't just very well behaved in jail. He also told MI5 everything he knew. I mean, he confessed everything the moment he was arrested. He told MI5 everything he knew about his KGB handlers, the methods they used, his awareness of other spies, which was effectively zero, and also as much as he could remember about the documents he'd handed over. So, I mean, clearly a young man who'd made many mistakes, but one who tried to exonerate for his crimes and was released from jail in 1972, did write a volume of memoirs, which he instantly regretted, and then avoided the media spotlight. So unlike the Cambridge spies who were still living, who were in Moscow and almost sort of reveled in the fact they were gentlemen rogues and occasionally gave interviews to the media, for the last 20 years of Vassal's life from the mid-70s to his death in 1996, he was below the radar living in a bedsit in St. John's Wood and changed his name to John Phillips.
What did he do with his time?
Well, he had great difficulty finding a job at first, as you might imagine. So he worked for a few months in 1973-74 in a Catholic monastery in Sussex. He had converted, although he was a Church of England vicar's son, he converted to Catholicism actually before he went to Moscow, and I think he'd been confirmed as a Catholic while he was in jail. So he worked as a sort of volunteer librarian in a Catholic monastery. Then he found a job for something called the British Records Association, which is the professional body for archivists, in a fairly lowly secretarial role. He worked there initially full-time, I think later part-time, for the best part of 20 years, I think, from 75 till about 1994, when he finally retired. I managed to discover, as part of my research for the book, I managed to discover two women who'd worked with him alongside him at the British Records Association, one of them in the mid-70s, the other one in the mid-90s, shortly before Vassal retired. And for many, many months, or in one case a year or so, they did not discover his true identity, because he introduced himself as John Phillips. He was always very vague about his past, for reasons we can all understand. And it was only after many months of working alongside him, and in fact befriending him, that they discovered his true identity. And even after that, he was very, very reluctant to talk about the past. So, he can't be accused of selling his story. He can't be accused of profiteering out of his spying, because although he did write a book of memoirs in 1975, it was frankly badly written, did not sell well, and he instantly regretted having written it.
I mean, two things I found interesting. One was that he was growing up, when I was growing up at a small village in Kent, he was in the next door village. And the other is that, in fact, he did have contact with some spy writers, Donald McCormick and Nigel West, but they just kept the whole thing very quiet. And I mean, so it didn't really come out, as you say, until really he died. And even then, it took several weeks for the press to pick up on the story.
Yeah, I mean, one of the few, it's fair to say, one of the few good things, sorry, one of the few accurate books that's been written about the Vassal case was a book by Richard Deacon and Nigel West called Spy in 1980. And there was also a BBC series alongside it, which is the only, the only proper dramatization of the Vassal story, broadcast on BBC One in January 1980, and surprisingly sympathetic, frank, and indeed, sensitive, betrayal of the story. Apart from that, a lot of stuff that's been written about Vassal is either drenched in homophobia or inaccurate. And I mean, to this day, when Vassal is featured on TV documentaries about espionage, crucial details of the story I got wrong, sometimes accused of being a paedophile because someone once alleged that the Russian men he'd been photographed having sex with were underage, for which there is no evidence whatsoever. He's also accused of being an accomplice of the far right, because while he was in Wormwood Scrubs prison in 63 or 64, he had very, very unwisely spoken to a British neo-fascist called Colin Jordan, who was also in Wormwood Scrubs for trying to set up some sort of right-wing militia, and effectively boasted to Colin Jordan about some of the important men he'd either befriended or slept with, which, again, I think is an example of Vassal's naivety rather than his malignancy. I don't think he was in any way sympathetic to either Soviet communism or British neo-fascism. But unfortunately, some of these myths about the Vassal case have persisted. And I think one of the reasons is not just his sexuality, that may be a factor, but also because he was childless, he never married or had children, though many gay men of his generation did. His only sibling was a brother called Richard, who also died childless in 2000. So Vassal does not have any children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, great-nephews or great-nieces to defend his legacy. As part of my research, I did my utmost to track down any surviving cousins of John Vassal. I did discover one cousin, must have been a sort of second cousin once removed, who, when I asked him about his knowledge of his distant cousin John, he said his first reaction was, "Who's John Vassal?" And he was completely unaware of the fact that he was related to John Vassal the spy until I contacted him. So it's fair to say that John Vassal does not have a large contingent of extended family members going out there to defend his legacy, and that's an important reason, among others, I believe, why.
What do you think is his legacy, and why were you drawn to wanting to write a book about him?
Well, why I was drawn to write a book about, I was actually originally going to write a book, as Andrew may know, I was going to write a book about Dolphin Square.
Yeah, I'm very sorry about that. Yeah.
I was going to write a book about Dolphin Square, where Vassal lived between 59 and his arrest in 62. And for various reasons, I decided to kind of focus in on one particular period in Dolphin Square in the late 50s, early 60s, because there were other interesting people living there alongside John Vassal. Sydney James of Carry On fame, Christine Keeler lived there briefly, Sarah Churchill, as you probably know, Winston's daughter, the actress, April Ashley, Britain's first transgender model. They all lived at Dolphin Square as John Vassal's neighbours at the same time, as did C.P. Snow, the famous novelist. And I, to cut a very long story short, I decided in the end to focus in on one particular tenant, namely John Vassal, simply because apart from one book written in 1964 and drenched in homophobia, no book has been written about John Vassal until now. He's obviously been mentioned in passing in many other books, but as I've already explained, often he's you're mentioned rather inaccurately. In terms of what his legacy is, well, I think it is a very poignant chapter in the LGBT history of the UK. And I'm a Labour man. Before I became a writer, was a Labour councillor in Greenwich, South London, for 16 years. And although I'm not gay, but I've always thought myself as a kind of LGBT ally. And I thought I understood the story of LGBT emancipation quite clearly. And I'd always seen it very much in sort of party political terms, in terms of, oh, these horrible bigoted Tories had opposed decriminalisation, and then thank heavens for the wonderful, liberalising Harold Wilson government for coming in 1964 and beginning to change things. Well, the truth is actually a lot more complicated than that, in that it's pretty clear there were a lot of very courageous Conservative MPs who were either semi-closeted gay men or were sympathetic to, decriminalisation, and who discovered that their careers were either severely curtailed or in some cases terminated because of their sexuality or because of their support for decriminalisation. Denzel Freith, Humphrey Barclay, for example. So these are not well-known names purely because their careers as Conservative MPs were terminated in 1964 and 1966, respectively, largely because of their,
as you said earlier, it was a long road from Wolfenden. It was 10 years.
Yeah, yeah,
but 10 years.
Yeah, it was a 10-year period. One of the reasons why it did take a full 10 years, Phil, is because of the sort of homophobic backlash that the Vassal case unleashed. but also there were just as many homophobes on the Labour benches in the House of Commons as there were on the Conservative ones. And of course, when decriminalisation finally did happen in the summer of 67, it was actually a private member's bill by a backbench MP, Leo Abbs. It was not government legislation.
Interesting. Very interesting.
So I think the whole Vassal story, and I hope my book will contribute towards this, is a useful corrective to this fairly simplistic understanding of the path to decriminalisation that seems to have become embedded in the left. To see it purely in party political terms, in terms of the Conservatives being the party of the homophobes and Labour being the party of liberalisation, which is very far from the truth, in my view.
I mean, one sort of footnote, but he was exposed really because a Soviet defector called Anatoly Galitsyn came forward. And Galitsyn's testimony has now been challenged, the suggestion that as he was a plant. And I've seen it suggested that there was a more senior spy in the Admiralty, and Vassal basically was sacrificed to protect that spy. Is there any truth in that?
Who knows? It could well be true. There was a gentleman called Colin Dunlop who became an admiral in the end and was allowed to retire in the early 70s. It was alleged both during and after Colin Dunlop's lifetime, I believe he died in 2009, that he was a Russian spy and had been from the 1940s or 50s onwards. And that Vassal was a less important spy to the Russians and had therefore been deliberately sacrificed by the Russians. So the Russians had sent over Galitsyn and possibly one or two other defectors with the deliberate intention of identifying John Vassal to the Americans, who'd obviously tell the British, on the basis that Vassal's capture, prosecution and imprisonment would reassure the British that they'd finally caught the only Russian spy in the Admiralty, and they would either stop looking for or pay no attention to a more important and more senior Russian spy, namely Colin Dunlop. And there's been a lot of speculation in the last few decades that Dunlop was protected not just by the Russians, but also by friends in high places, including Roger Hollis, who was obviously head of MI5 at the time. And there's still debate, to this day about whether Roger Hollis and possibly his deputy were Russian spies. I mean, my book does not draw any firm conclusions on this point, except to say that Vassal himself told MI5 he was not aware of any other spies in the Admiralty or indeed anywhere else. And seeing as he seems to have told the truth to MI5 about everything else, I see no reason to doubt him.
Because you benefited from a lot of MI5's five files being released in October 22. Do you think there are other files still to be released, or is it that's it? They've cleared the decks.
Oh, there are still other files to be released, and some of the files that were released 18 months ago were quite heavily redacted. It would also be good to go through some of the archives in Moscow once the state of Anglo-Russian relations improves, to allow that to happen. I mean, I had a very lucky break in that I started writing this book about 2 years ago, unaware of the fact that 18 months ago, a huge tranche of MI5 and other files about the case, which had been classified for 60 years, were suddenly declassified. So, I mean, very intriguing details there, both about the questioning of Vassal that happened at the hands of an MI5 officer called Charles Elwell when he was in jail, but also the identity of two Conservative members of Parliament who Vassal had a friendship with, and certainly in at least one case, a sexual relationship with in 1961, 1962. And this is one of the great paradoxes of the Vassal case, in that a number of men who had only known Vassal socially had almost certainly not had sexual relations with him, had their careers terminated or very severely impeded. Whereas Sir Harmer Nicholls, a long-standing veteran conservative backbencher, who Vassal told MI5 had had a sexual relationship with him in the winter of 1961-1962, somehow managed to keep Harmer Nicholls, being Conservative MP for Peterborough from 1950 and remained Conservative MP for Peterborough until 1974. Somehow this was kept out of the newspapers and his political career carried on unimpeded. In fact, after Harmer Nicholls lost his seat in 74, he was given a peerage in 75 and served as an MEP in Manchester in the early 1980s. So, in his case, his political career continued for more than 20 years after MI5 discovered his association with John Vassal, whereas in other cases, political careers or civil service careers or military careers were terminated quite brutally in the mid-1960s because of the mere suggestion that John Vassal had known somebody. In one case, one MP was forced to give up his safe seat merely because it was alleged he'd once been to a party with John Vassal.
That's incredible.
Oh, had any form of sexual
It was a very different time.
I mean, the book's been out a month. Has anything emerged from people writing to you since the book came out?
Good new question. I mean, I had an email from an email from an old friend of John Vassal's immediately after the book came out to say she had dined with John Vassal 2 days before his death in 1996. And I was also contacted last week by a lady whose father, sadly now deceased, but whose late father had been naval attaché in Moscow, not in Vassal's day, but a few years later, and has offered me to put in touch with other colleagues in the British Embassy Moscow who may have known Vassal. I mean, because the key events of this story took place in the 1950s and the 1960s, I was born in 1973. So, I mean, all the crucial things, all the crucial parts or the most crucial parts of this story happened a good 10 years before I was born. And unfortunately, because of, Anni Domini, many of the crucial people it would have been good to speak to about this case are no longer with us. Having said that, I did manage to track down a couple of people who had known John Vassal in the 1950s, and someone who'd met him in jail, and someone who'd been involved in the tapping of Admiralty phones, between Vassal's arrest and Vassal's prosecution. So there are still people out there who knew John Vassal. He died relatively recently, less than 30 years ago. But sadly, they are somewhat dwindling. So if anyone out there who's listening to this does have any connection to John Vassal, I hope there will be a paperback edition of the book in due course. And I'll be delighted to hear from you.
Well, we'll put up a link to the book in our bio, as we always do.
I recommend it.
Yes, well, and also it's a world, isn't it? It's a lost world. It's a rather dark world. But you really brought it to life. And you've done him some credit, I think, actually. I'm glad he finally found somebody to tell his story properly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on. I've really enjoyed talking to you both.
Really nice to talk to you. All the best.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Well, that is a very sad story, Mr. Vassal, isn't it? I don't think I'd realise quite how dark a tale it really was. Makes you think about... I've always many people that talk about, oh, God, Britain was better in the past, things are terrible now, and in so many ways, that's not true. In so many ways.
It's a sad life, but that's true of a lot of these spies. But I suppose, he lived on, came out of prison and had this life, met a lot of people, including other spy writers. So it shows you that, I suppose, there is life afterwards, and yet no one knew about it. And I suppose we've got another sad spy story coming up on Sunday.
Yes.
Gareth Williams, The Body in the Bag, which is something people have been asking us about, in which the man who's going to talk to us, Robert Verkerk, tried to write a book about, in fact, that I tried to agent. And that is one of the great mysteries, you know, exactly in what circumstances did he die? And I'm hoping Robert will be able to answer some of those questions.
So Robert wanted to write a book and you were trying to help him and nobody wanted to buy it. No publisher.
At that time, no. I mean, it's one of those strange things. A lot of it is about timing. I think there's, you know, new material has come to light since. I mean, that was some years ago. So I hope maybe he will go back to the subject. I mean, it's there's still a lot, I think, that could be said, and hopefully part of that will be said on Sunday. But we've got quite a lot lined up, actually, for the next few weeks. We've been quite busy.
We do. I was just thinking, actually, because that the Gareth Williams story was one of those sort of early signs. Because just to mention a few things about it, he was looking at what the Russians were up to, aspects of the Russian state and the Russian state relationship with organized crime. And I think it was it before the poisonings had begun? Around that time, it was just like the first inkling that there was a new Cold War. Like we are going back to the 60s in that respect. And it's the Russians again, but a different kind of Russians.
And the Russian reach stretched to basically the streets of London.
Yeah, that's right, with poisons and maybe with having people put in bags and then trying to smear them. I mean, it's an incredible tale. I'm looking forward to that. And yeah, loads of other things coming up. We're finally going to get around to Infected Blood, which we've been sitting on for some time. And we have another, I was really pleased to say that in about 3 weeks, we're talking to Hannah Barnes, who has written this amazing multi-award-winning book on the Tavistock in treatment of children at the Tavistock in London for gender dysphoria. And this is one of the most controversial, most difficult subjects I think you and I have taken on. And it's going to be hard to do it in a sort of fair-minded way because people's views on this issue are so polarized. But Hannah's book is fantastic, and it's got praise from all sorts of different people from all sides of the debate. So I think that's going to be a really good conversation.
And Richard Norton Taylor is going to come and talk to us. He's a very distinguished Guardian journalist. He's going to talk about a series of scandals, I think. I mean, he was involved in the Scott inquiry, but also he wrote a play on the Grenfell Tower,
tower block that burnt down.
And there's a big story there about really cladding now on buildings. You know, has this led to any change in the regulations? Is it going to be proper compensation? Has it all, you know, I suspect the situation hasn't really changed.
We're getting into a nice rhythm. I mean, like with the spies, people write to us and ask us to look at stories. And then through our connections, and when I say our, I mean mostly Andrew's, through Andrew's connections in the world of publishing, we can get like the very best writers on these subjects to come and talk to us. She's fantastic.
We've been very lucky.
I never thought we'd do that.
People do feel that we do get some good people, and we've been very lucky. People come and there's nothing in it for them. It's such a bit of publicity and a chance to perhaps talk about a subject that interests them.
They get a mug, Andrew. Come on, they're all important.
They get a mug. That's true. Well,
it should be inducement enough.
And it's part of a very elite little group if you've been on the program. But what else have we got? I mean, we're going to talk about European royals. Scandals there.
And we are going to go back to some of our greatest hits. We've got our little gang now. We've got Laura, Lady Colin Campbell, Valentine, Gerard.
Lady Colin Campbell, and indeed Robin and Anthony Somers. Yeah. I hope they will come and talk to us again. But we're always open to suggestions of things that might interest you. And we like to have a wide variety of subjects and perspectives, I suppose.
Yeah, well, we joked the other day about being like turning into a current affairs program. I mean, we're not. But, you know, if there are things people want us to find out, we are quite well placed to find them out. Of course, we now have this platform and we have, you know, our connections from our careers. We can get to people. And we think, you know, there seems to be an audience for the way that we ask questions and give people the chance to speak. And a lot of you said very nice things about that. So thank you, and please keep watching, and please keep looking and listening, and please keep kicking and liking and subscribing and all that stuff, because it really matters.
Yep. Thanks very much, and
thank
see you Sunday.
Much. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team at podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.